Welcome to Conversations of the Strange.
Conversations of the Strange.
Everybody, welcome to another episode of Conversations of the Strange. I am Don Everett Smith Jr., and I am your host. Tonight, we continue going in our true crime direction with a wonderful author. Since 1984, the Texas-based writer Catherine Casey has written for several well-known publications. However, she began writing true crime books in 1992 with The Chilling Evil Beside Her, which was the story of a brave woman who was married to a peeping Tom, who became a serial rapist. Thankfully, he was caught before his crimes could escalate. In total, Miss Casey has written 11 true crime books. My personal favorite is A Warrant to Kill, which details how a rather unhinged local police officer bullied, lied, and manipulated his way through his career in law enforcement. After he shot and killed Susan White, a rather troubled soul herself, he was arrested, tried, and is currently in jail. Catherine's books read like page-turning novels. Thankfully, she's written 4 novels about her character, Sarah Armstrong. Miss Casey has appeared on The Oprah Winfrey Show, Oprah Winfrey's Oxygen Network, Court TV, Biography, Nancy Grace, The E! Network, Investigation Discovery, The A&E Channel, and The Montel Williams Show. She's a regular at book festivals and has spoken at the Texas Library Association Convention, Southwest Louisiana's Writers Conference, the Pulpwood Queen's Girlfriend Weekend Book Conference, and the Texas Book Festival. Tonight, we will be talking to Catherine about her latest true crime book, In Plain Sight, The Coffin County Prosecutor Murders, which came out in 2018. The late true crime writer Ann Rule called Catherine Casey one of the best in the true crime genre. I will further say, Miss Casey is the reigning queen of true crime. Catherine, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, well, thank you, Don. It's very kind of you.
So, in 2018, In Plain Sight, The Coffman County Prosecutor Murders was released from HarperCollins. Can you explain a little bit about who the murder victims were?
Well, this is a really strange case because people don't kill district attorneys and assistant district attorneys. They know that the wrath of law enforcement will come down on them if they do. But in 2013, in the small town of Kaufman, Texas, first an assistant district attorney named Mark Hassey was murdered, gunned down not far from the courthouse at 9 o'clock in the morning when he was going to work. And then a month later, actually 2 months later in March, the Saturday before Easter, his boss, the district attorney, and the DA's wife were killed just execution style in their home outside of Kaufman. And it just shook throughout the entire country.
Right, right. Now, what type of area is Kaufman like? Is this like a middle-class town, very rural, somewhat metropolitan?
Well, Kaufman County is southeast of Dallas, a little ways, and it's kind of the northern part of it that's closest to Dallas has become kind of a bedroom community. It's kind of a suburb of Dallas. But Kaufman is more rural. And the city of Kaufman is a small town. It's got a lot of tiny little houses with small yards. And the courthouse is in the center of town. It's kind of an undistinguished-looking building. Some of our Texas courthouses are beautiful, but this one you would drive by and not think of again. And, you know, it's just, it wasn't in an area that was particularly wealthy. There were a lot of people in the area who did have money, and they had big cattle ranches. But the courthouse is really the center of the community. It's the center of the city and the center of the community.
Gotcha. Now, are the district attorneys, are they elected or are they appointed?
The district attorney in Texas is appointed within each of the counties, and then they hire their staff. So Mike McClellan was elected, and he hired Mark Hassey.
Gotcha. And one of their connections was Eric Williams. He was apparently a justice of the peace that had been arrested for stealing $600 worth of computer equipment.
It's really a strange one. Eric was an attorney, and he was a well-placed attorney who did family law in Kaufman, and he ran for his office at the same time that Mike McClellan ran for the DA's office, and there was bad blood between the two of them. And Eric won his seat that year just like Mike did, and Eric became a JP in the town. And they both had quite a bit of power. These are real power positions in this little town in Texas.
Gotcha. And what Eric would do as justice of the peace, now would this be the person that would do the occasional wedding, listens to traffic traffic citations? This would be the guy that hears your basic man was arrested for drugs, and then Eric would sentence him. Is that what the justice of the peace did?
Pretty much, yeah. It was kind of like a small claims court, and misdemeanor offenses, some low-grade felonies.
Gotcha. Why was there such bad blood between Eric and, I want to make sure I get his name right, McClellan, was that it?
Mm-hmm. That's right. You know, they started out not liking each other. It was kind of a chemical thing when the two of them met. People who worked with them at the time said that from the beginning there was kind of this tug of war going on between the two of them. And then Eric turned Mike in, cost Mike a job, because Mike was working for the state at the time and doing some additional work he shouldn't have been doing. And then Eric went up against him in the election where he backed Mike's opponent. So there were just a lot of things that had kind of, you know, come together that had put the two of them at odds.
Amazing. Now, what inspired Eric then to steal $600 worth of computer equipment? Because this is kind of where the whole snowball starts going down the hill, if I could phrase it that way.
Mm-hmm. No, that's a good way to put it. You know, it was stupid. I mean, it was just a ridiculous thing. But Eric didn't like asking for things. He liked to go ahead and be the big guy and just take what he wanted. And as the JP, he had a budget to buy technology for his office. But instead of doing that, he went into the IT department and walked out with three monitors. They were around $200 a piece, so it was a total of $600. He put one of them on his desk in the JP's office in the courthouse. He had one at the house, and he was taking one over to the jail, and he was setting up a video magistration system for the county that he'd been telling people he wanted to do. But he shouldn't have done it that way. He wasn't entitled to walk into the IT department and walk out with them. If there hadn't been that bad blood, they might have been able to talk it through.
Right.
But since there was this animosity between them, it mushroomed.
Right. Now let's take back, because in your book, you focus a lot on Eric's early years. That's one of the things that's so amazing about it. Like, this is not just a case of, okay, Eric did this silly thing where he stole the computers, and then you just started there, and then it goes up until the trial and what resulted from that. You go all the way back. Like, you're like, let's find out what mom and dad were like. You really go into his background, as well as his wife Kim, who was also part of this. How did you start getting into this? Did you like how do you start taking notes on this and start finding out people's backgrounds like this?
You know, I always start with the trial. I go to the trials. A lot of the some of the true crime writers don't, but I always do. And it's a real commitment because they'll go on for weeks and weeks. I've been in a courtroom for 6 or 7 weeks for a book. I think this trial was around 3 to 4 weeks. And I meet people there. So at the trial, I met Eric's dad, and I met his aunt, and I met his brother-in-law. And I exchanged information with them. And so that I heard their testimony at the trial, during the trial. And then I followed up afterwards. And I do that with everything. You know, I start with kind of the core, and then I work my way out. And by the time I'm writing a book, I've usually interviewed about 100 people.
Wow.
And, yeah, it's a real commitment, but that's the way that you really understand how something unfolded. Because the person that Eric was as a child influences what he's like as an adult.
Right.
And it explains why he made such a foolish decision. And when he made that decision, then he was unable to step back. And the same thing for Mike McClellan. You know, we are who we are, and we're a product of our past. So the past is really important.
Right. Now, did Eric, in his early days, based on your conversations that you talked to and other people and resources, did he give any sort of inclination that he had a potential temper like this, that it wouldn't take much for him to be unhinged and go and commit an act like this? Did he have a history of revenge and violence and letting his temper go a little bit out of control?
Well, there were some things. He killed his sister's cat at one point.
Oh, jeez.
Shot it through the eye. He didn't like cats, so that was kind of a recurring problem.
Uh-huh.
He'd say odd things to people. Like, Eric, on one hand, was like this model citizen. I mean, he had a certificate as a law enforcement officer. He was an Eagle Scout. He was in the Texas National Guard. So he was kind of this, you know, hero figure. But he'd say odd things like, if I go out, I'm going to take a lot of people with me. And then he would smile. And he was kind of this funny, nerdy kind of guy. And everybody was like, well, that's just Eric. Eric's different. But sometimes people would say things like, well, you know, maybe one of these days Eric will be shooting people from the top of the courthouse. People had kind of a funny feel about him,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, they just kind of excused it because they liked Eric. He was smart, and he was funny, and he was quirky, and I don't think anybody ever thought that he could become this unraveled.
Right, because I was reading in one of the interviews that he was described as creepy, that some of the friends or some of the people that worked with him said that they use, like, I remember seeing that, creepy. And was that what it was that was creeping people out, that whole thing? Like, you know what, if I've got to shoot a bunch of people, I'll shoot a bunch of people.
Well, yeah. I mean, I live in Texas, and there are a lot of people down here who have firearms. It's not all that unusual. But he had an arsenal of firearms. And, you know, there was just something about Eric that was a little off. You know, and people did notice it.
Right. Well, what's funny is that I go back and I think of the movie Office Space, and actually directed by a fellow Texan, Mike Judge. And there's this one part in the movie, and granted this happened in 2000, where one of the office workers is going, he's like, you know what, some days I just feel like coming into work and just with a gun and just going... And it was just kind of like laugh, laugh, ha, ha, ha. We get that we've had those days of frustration. But in the last 20 years since it came out, mm-hmm. That's not exactly something people can joke about, especially post-Columbine, where there are people that are showing up to work with guns and just taking their frustrations out on their coworkers. So mm-hmm. it's sort of like it's sort of like, it's weird. We can't even joke like that. Like, 30 years ago, we could say, like, yeah, I'm coming in tomorrow with a couple of grenades. Ha ha ha. But now, in this day and age, you can't really do that. And this is a pretty fairly recent murder, too. This all happened in 2013. So this isn't like that this happened in, like, the 1960s or something like that.
Well, you know, I think people did hear, they listened to Eric when he said these bizarre things, and they took note of them. And sometimes they would say to each other, you know, Eric's a little odd. Do you think, you know, Eric's okay? Or do you think Eric could really do anything like that? But it was never to the point where they actually thought that he was capable of it.
Right. That's still just really scary.
It is. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, after Eric stole the $600 worth of computer equipment, Mike McClelland, the DA, basically rains pretty much legal hell down on him, if I could put it that way. He does everything he possibly can, pushes the extent of the law, makes Eric look bad. In fact, I want to see if I can get this name right. I believe that there was an ex-girlfriend involved with this, and I want to see if I can get her name. Was it Janice? Do I have that right? Or there was an ex-girlfriend that was involved with the prosecution.
Oh, one of the clerks, a court clerk from another county that Eric threatened at one point.
Right, and she was brought in, and I think that really, really hurt his ego, from what I understand. And he was tried, and ultimately, wasn't he disbarred and removed as justice of the peace for committing this?
You know, he was. And I think in any other circumstance, there would have been something negotiated down. Eric offered to give up the justice of the peace slot, which was very important to him, if he could keep his law license. But Mike McClelland wanted everything. He was out for blood.
Yeah.
And he pretty basically ruined Eric and his wife. Eric lost his job. He lost the JP slot. He lost his law license. He couldn't be in the Texas National Guard anymore. He lost his health insurance, and he was a type 1 diabetic, and his wife was suffering from multiple illnesses and was actually an invalid at that point. So, he pretty much destroyed Eric, Mike did.
Right, so this would be the equivalent of expelling a kid for like wearing an inappropriate t-shirt to school.
Well, you know, I mean, there were $600 worth of computers, and one of them was on Eric's desk at the county. He hadn't even taken it out of the building. So that left $400, and you know, and Eric had been talking about starting this video conferencing system. So Mike, you know, saw an opening, and he went for blood. He ran on a cleanup Kaufman County platform when he ran for the DA's office, and this case fit right in there. You know, here I'm cleaning up Kaufman County. I'm getting rid of Eric Williams. So it doesn't excuse what Eric then did, but it explains how this escalated.
Right, right. Whereas a lot of the murders that you covered, like, for instance, if you go all the way back to Evil Beside Her, and I forget the names of the individuals that were involved, but you see how this lady was involved with her husband and what she did, and you clearly see that she was a very innocent party while her husband went out and did all of those very horrible things, and you kind of rooted for her. And the sad thing is that in this situation, again, you don't excuse Eric's actions, but there is, I hate to say the word sympathy, but you kind of feel somewhat empathetic about the situation that he was in. And especially now, like, we're in a post-coronavirus world where mm-hmm. people are losing their jobs, people are desperate, people are probably going to end up having to move in with other relatives, and all these small businesses may end up losing businesses. Say a prayer for all that, but it's one of those things where it's just kind of like you kind of understand why. You know what I mean? Like, there's a level you almost have empathy for Eric. Not again, you don't want to sit there and go, "Why, Eric, I would have done the exact same thing that he did," but you can at least understand the feeling of anger, disappointment, betrayal, and the way that he was treated.
I think looking back, I think Eric was a functioning sociopath. He had his life on a track. He was working hard. He was accomplishing things. He went through law school. He ran for the JP's job and got it. And I think he probably would have continued his life being a little odd and a little on the edge, but, you know, okay. I think he would have done all right. But this really was the trigger.
Right.
He became desperate and angry.
Right.
And obsessed. Now, with getting right. even.
How old was Eric at this point?
He was in his mid-40s. I think he was about 46.
Okay. And let's talk about the... can we go back and talk about the first crime with Mr. Massey? Because it was very, very disturbing, actually. Again, I don't... We understand where Eric went, why Eric was feeling the way that he did. But when you actually look at what he did mm-hmm. himself, it's really quite twisted. Now,
yeah.
you have mentioned that he was obsessed with a particular movie, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, which will kind of lead into the death of Mr. Massey.
Well, Eric was really into movies. Like, he watched that mall cop movie and went out and bought himself a Segway and was driving around in this neighborhood in this small Texas town on his Segway reading books off and on, sometimes with an AK weapon hanging off of his back. And he kind of enjoyed that, and one of his favorite movies was Tombstone, the Wyatt Earp movie.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in Tombstone there's the shootout at the OK Corral. And it's right outside, like in kind of a town square, right off the town square in this town.
Right.
And they all are wearing black. And, you know, when he decided how he was going to kill Mark Assey, he told Kim, his wife, Eric told Kim, his wife, that it was going to be Mark's tombstone.
Mm. And he wore... From what I read, he wore black and he wore a mask. Do you know what type of mask that was? I was reading that it was something ghoulish.
It was an executioner's mask. It had the black netting on the front. It was like a hood.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah, it was ghoulish. He was really excited about it and the way he would dress and how he would look. And he actually kind of modeled everything for Kim the night before.
Right.
And, put a lot of thought into it. He became obsessed with getting even, and it overtook his life.
Right. And why did he choose to shoot Mr. Massey first? Why not? Honestly, in all of this, if he didn't like Mr. McClellan, it would just seems like it would make sense that he would walk up, go to Mr. McClellan's first, take out Mr. McClellan, and then be done with it. Like, why Mr. Massey?
Well, Mark Massey was the main prosecutor on Eric's case. He was the one who stood in front of the courtroom and put on the evidence. He put on Eric's former girlfriend and asked her the questions about what Eric had done
right.
To her, how Eric had threatened her with the gun. And he was the one who asked the jury to, he was one of the ones, along with Mike McClelland, who asked the jury to throw the book at Eric and take everything away. So, you know, he was angry at Mike and at Mark. Mike second chaired at the trial. Mike did not have, Mike McClelland was the DA, but he didn't have a lot, very much experience at all in criminal law. So Mark was the actual prosecutor at the case.
Right. And what was disturbing about this was when Mark, or when Eric showed up right before when Eric showed up to shoot Mr. Massey, Kim was quoted as saying, "I asked Mark if he had said anything, and he told me Mark said, no, no, please, no." So Mr. Massey was literally begging for his life right before Eric shot him, which makes it, which makes this, again, it adds to the level of disturbance where you would hope that somebody, something would have switched off in his brain that made him go, wait, what am I doing?
I think Eric enjoyed the fact that he begged. Eric was really kind of playing a part. You know, he saw himself as kind of a, I don't know, superhero is probably not the right word, a supervillain, like in a Batman movie or something. He envisioned himself. He liked games. He liked, you know, that kind of thing. He liked movies. And I think he just envisioned this as a part that he was playing, hence the costume and everything that he went through. Mark Hasse was, you know, not a big guy. He was kind of a smaller guy, and Eric just overpowered him out on the street and started to shoot him.
Right. Now, do you think Mark Massey had any idea who this was?
It's Hasse, H-A-S-S-E.
Oh, Hasse, I'm sorry.
That's okay. I think Mark knew that it was Eric. Mark was worried. Actually, a lot of people in Kaufman, after Eric lost everything, a lot of them were worried about Eric. They thought that he might go off the deep end, as the old cliche goes. And so they were concerned, and Mark was especially concerned. He had started wearing a gun. He was telling people that he was afraid of Eric. He thought something might happen. He and Mike both did. So I'm, you know, and for him to say, no, no, please don't, out on the street, I think Eric got right in his face and made sure that Mark knew who he was.
Gotcha. Yeah, because, like, you've seen this all the time in, like, movies where, like, people know the revenge or what have you. It's just like, hey, I want you to know who I am. You know, like a V for Vendetta. I don't know if you've ever seen that movie or what have you, but there is a scene where a masked figure that had been brutalized by government officials leans forward and he says to John Hurt, he's like, I just want you to know who I am. And John Hurt realizes it and he starts crying, and then that's when John Hurt gets killed. And after that, if there was all of this going on, all of the other articles I've read about Eric Williams said that after Mr. Hasse was killed, people believe that it was either a Mexican drug cartel or an Aryan Brotherhood. Why? How did they come up in all of this? Because it seems like everybody knew that, yeah, there's a really good chance this was Eric Williams that did this, and I'm pretty sure Mr. McClellan would be next on his list. Why? Where did the Aryan Brotherhood aspect come from?
There had been a report that was released right about that time. It was a warning that had come out from the Texas Department of Public Safety, and they monitor what goes on in the prisons. And the Aryan Brotherhood is really a group that functions within the prison systems. And the report warned that there was some indication that they were talking about going out onto the street and that they were going to be going after law enforcement or public officials. So when this happened, that rumor got started based on that report, and it just picked up like wildfire. And then a bunch of, there were a lot of different law enforcement agencies working on this case, the Secret Service, Homeland Security, the FBI, the Texas Rangers, you know, and then the county sheriff, the local police department, there were a whole group. when that rumor got started, instead of focusing on Eric Williams, who was a smart guy and had a lawyer, they started running out to the prisons all over the country interviewing inmates, and it really diluted the investigation. It was a real problem.
Do you think that that was one of the reasons why, like you said, it diluted it, it took the resources elsewhere? Do you think if they had those resources, that there would have been an opportunity to have prevented Mr. McClellan from having Mr. and Mrs. McClellan, I should say, from having them having been shot then?
You know, I think it might have, Don. You know, it's sad to think back and believe that, but I think if they had really gone after Eric the way that they should have and just totally focused on him. Mike McClellan, the day that Mark Hasse was gunned down, Mike stood over Mark's body at the hospital and looked at a couple of people there, the medical examiner and one of the, and the county judge, the justice of the peace who'd taken over for Eric, and said, Eric Williams did this. And for the next 2 months, he told everybody he talked to that Eric had killed Mark. And at the same time, it's not that they were discounting it or they didn't think that Eric was a suspect, but the investigators from all these agencies were looking at a lot of suspects, and they didn't really zero in on Eric.
Right, and it's not like Eric had a history of, or a known, shall I say, a known history of committing acts of violence and other type of actions like this. You know what I mean? Like where you'll find out someone who's been arrested for murder, you can go, oh, this guy's had a whole series of arrests over violent crimes, and then murder was just the next step. It just literally seemed like he went from thievery / arrogance to full out, let's do revenge killings.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you know, there were some people, like the county sheriff there told me that he knew that, you know, Eric was kind of a wild card, but he didn't think he was actually capable of killing anyone. There was that kind of blockade at the threshold there that you had to get past in order to visualize Eric Williams as a cold-blooded killer.
Right.
And it was hard for some people to get to that point.
Right. Again, because this was a friend. This was a funny guy. This was a charming guy. This was a guy who, hey, Eric, you want to go to the movies? Yeah, sure. Like, this was a guy that probably, he was the go-to guy to call out to go see the new Marvel movie. You want to go see Captain America? Yeah, that'll be great. How about Avengers? Sure, I'm right there with you.
Yeah. So Eric was a lot of fun. Has a great sense of humor. You know, and he's smart, and people like being around him. So,
yeah.
I mean, he's a complex person.
Yeah. Now, when Eric does shoot Mr. McClellan, they make a big, like, he makes a big deal, because I was reading that he put on a whole like police officer's outfit. In fact, I had actually taken a picture of it today, because I was sharing this with someone, and I was sharing this with somebody about how he put on the costume, and just as a side note, it reminded me of the Missy Beavers case, where you had another individual, and in fact, I was talking about the Eric Williams case with Crystal Lawson, one of the hosts of the True Crime Broads that have been, they're friends of the show, and we were talking about the Missy Beavers case not too long ago, and we were pointing out the similarities between this, and I was actually asking if there was a chance that the Missy Beavers murderer was inspired by what was going on with the Eric Williams story, because it was just all over Texas like that. Like I imagine that this was the sort of thing that, whether you're from Amarillo, El Paso, and everything in between, this is what you're seeing on the front page, like latest update in the Kaufman prosecutor's murder saga. And can you explain what exactly happened? Because from what I understand, he didn't tell Kim, who had Kim, his wife, acted as the getaway driver. It seemed like with the McClellan case, it was he got them early in the morning and he shot Mrs. McClellan first, if I'm correct, and then he shot Mr. McClellan, and he basically finished off Mrs. McClellan when she was still moaning and still alive. Did I get that correct?
You did.
Okay.
He had told Kim, Eric told Kim his wife at one point, this was Easter weekend, and she said, what if the family's there? What if they have family in from out of town? And Eric said, well, then they'd all just be collateral damage. I can't let them live or they would be witnesses. So he went there, you know, intending to kill who was ever in that house that day. And what they believe happened is that Cynthia, seeing this SWAT officer at her door, because Eric was, as you said, dressed in a costume again, opened the door and, you know, went to call Mike. And when she did, Eric burst through and started shooting her first and then went after Mike. The irony was that Mike had 120 some guns in that house.
Oh, wow.
He was all armed up and he couldn't get to any of them when he needed one.
Right, right. Now, obviously, like with what happened, the relationship between him and Eric was there was a lot of bad blood, and Mike can be considered it really does come across in the situation like he was necessarily vindictive, which seems like it contributed to his downfall. But what type of man was Mike McClellan? Was he other than what we just mentioned? Was he a nice guy? Was he the type of guy that would that you could call it if you had a problem? What did the family say about Mike McClellan or his coworkers say about him?
You know, Mike and Mark and Cynthia were all very loved by their families. Mike had kind of, he was a little egotistical. He was a little full of himself, people said. But he was a lot of fun and he cared about people. He was kind of one of those larger than life people. You know, he was actually in counseling for most of his career and had worked at one point for the state of Texas as a counselor in cases that went to court, like family court cases.
Mm-hmm.
So he had a background in like psychology, and so did Cynthia. She worked actually at one of the psychiatric hospitals in the area up there, one of the state hospitals. And they were good people. I mean, they sang in the choir at church on Sundays, and they taught Sunday school, and they had a lot of friends. They threw a great party every Christmas, and people looked forward to it, you know, and they liked to see Mike. Mike was just a good guy.
Right, right. And I imagine, like, to be somebody like that, I've always thought that there is a level of I don't know if you want to call it arrogance or a level of chutzpah when you serve in public office like that, because you're basically saying, you know what we've got going on in this country, county, state, city, is really not going the right way, and it needs somebody like me to get in there and turn it around and make it better for everybody. That's guts. That's chutzpah. Mm-hmm. That could be considered arrogance. So to do something like what he did, you would need almost that type of personality. Again, mm-hmm. not too much. There's one extreme. There's all these extremes, obviously. But it sounds like you would need that type of personality to do that. And this is Texas. And as they say, everything's bigger in Texas, too. So, but
yeah.
Now, after the murder occurred, the first murder occurred in January of 2013. And then this occurred March 30th, 2000. Mr. McClellan's murder occurred in 2013. How was Eric caught? Because I was hearing that he was doing interviews saying, I didn't do it, which to me, that just kind of does what they call the Streisand effect, where the more you say, I didn't do something, then people are going to start going, well, maybe you did, you know, smoke, fire, that type of thing. Like, wouldn't it have just been better if he just kind of kept his mouth shut and just kind of kept his head down? Because it seems like, ultimately, there's this level of, it was me, it was me. I didn't do it. It was me. Like, it's weird. It's kind of like he almost wanted to sign his work, but he signed his name backwards type of thing.
Well, you're right. It would have been better for him if he had, you know, if he had stopped after Mark, I think he probably would have gotten away with the one killing because they really were at a point where they were not able to solve that one in the 3 months. And then after he killed Mike and Cynthia, you know, he lost his protection. His lawyer said the police were going directly to him. And he had that personality trait where he always thought he was the smartest guy in the room. And he always talked about the police officers like they weren't all that bright. So when a Texas Ranger and one of the guys from the Sheriff's Department showed up on his door and asked to get into his house to do a search, Eric was a lawyer. Eric knew they were entitled. Eric should have said no. But he let them in. And they found enough during that search in order to be able to search warrants and have probable cause. And then when they got in and did a complete search, then they started to find things. It's another one of those, you know, it's not me, it is me, it's not me, it is me things. He was also emailing tips into Crime Stoppers the case and putting in facts that only the killer would know. And when they searched the house, they found on a sheet of paper the number for the Crime Stoppers chip.
Oh, goodness.
Yeah.
See, what's crazy about that is that reads like every other, like when you hear stories of like serial killers that are assisting in the search for the little girl that goes missing that they themselves killed. And it just, at this point in time, it seems like it's gone from revenge killing to almost serial killing at this point in time. Is this part of what you were calling the psychopathic behavior, that whole, I need everybody to know that I was the one that did this, la-di-da-di-da, like, look at me type of thing?
Yeah, you know, as I said, I think Eric was a functioning sociopath before this. And I think the trigger went off and it pushed him over the edge, and then everything became fair game. And he did have this giant ego, and he did want people on one level. I think you're right. I think he did want people to know that he had done it. And on the other hand, I think he just thought he would enjoy letting them into his house to search the house. And he felt so confident that he was so much smarter than they were that they wouldn't find anything.
Right.
But they found a couple of things that were, it was enough to get the judge to sign the warrant.
Right.
And that's all they needed. Once they got in the house, the pieces started to fall together.
Right. Now, ultimately, he's arrested for it. Kim's arrested for it. And when you start reading about, like, the legal defenses, because both Kim and Eric were tried separately, and it seems as if it becomes a case of she said, he said. Like, Eric is saying, oh, I'm an innocent party. She was the one that pushed me into it. And then she turns around and – actually, I take that back. Eric has denied doing this from what I understand. Like, he said it wasn't me. And – however, he did say that if I did do it, then it was Kim's fault. And Kim said that I've been pretty much on an opioid addiction and I was pretty much high most of the time and he had control of me. And it seems like that they went back and forth. Do you think that Eric was the mastermind of all of this, or do you think that Kim was the mastermind, or do you think they played a 50-50 in this?
No, I think Eric was the mastermind. I think Kim was so strung out on all of the medication she was taking. I don't think she really was thinking clearly at the time. But I do think she had bought in. I mean, they lost, as I said, really everything. And were at a point where they were going to lose their home and lose lose it all, including their health insurance, which, you know, she couldn't afford to lose. She was really in bad shape. She had rheumatoid arthritis, right, and a syndrome that caused all kinds of problems. So I think she was angry. I know she was angry. She told me she was angry at Mike and at Mark. And so part of her was kind of a cheerleader, was cheering Eric on, you know.
Right.
It's a very, the whole case is incredibly sad. I mean, you have very intelligent people who had their whole lives ahead of them, and, you know, look how it ended.
Right. And ultimately, Cindy is found guilty for her part in the two murders, for basically being the getaway driver, and she was sentenced to 40 years.
Yeah, Kim got 40 years.
Yeah. Did I say Cindy? I'm sorry. I
meant
Kim.
Okay. Yeah.
I apologize.
You're thinking of Cynthia, I think, but yeah, it's Kim. Kim got 40 years, and Eric got the death penalty.
Right. Do you think Eric would not have gotten the death penalty if this were another if this had not been an elected law enforcement official, and kind of, I hate to say, Eric's attitude toward law enforcement? Because sometimes you'll see that where, like, if a person has this sort of like a cop stink, I hate the cops had it coming, there's a level of that police officers do not exactly treat that perpetrator as kindly as they would to, say, another average person that's just arrested for doing something stupid.
You know, I think, Don, that this was so horrendous. I mean, shooting Mark, you know, in broad daylight like that, just walking, it was so brazen. And then, 2 months later, going into their home and killing Mike and Cynthia.
Yeah.
These are such atrocious murders. That at least here in Texas, I'm pretty sure that one way or the other, he probably would have gotten the death penalty.
Right.
You know, it maybe if he had only killed, I mean, you hate to use only in conjunction with the murder, because every murder is a horrible thing.
Yeah.
But if he had stopped after Mark, you know, maybe he would have gotten a lighter sentence.
Right,
but,
you know, like,
yeah,
I was going to say, like, he probably would have gotten life without parole or something like that.
He might have. We do have that as an option in Texas now. You know, and the other thing is that they did try him on Cynthia's murder, and Cynthia was an innocent bystander in all of this. She had done nothing to harm Eric Williams.
Right, she was in a, quote, collateral damage, which just makes it even worse. So, now, with everything going on, there's obviously appeals and everything. Can we spend a couple of minutes and talk about the creation of the book itself?
Sure.
There are all kinds of crimes that happen all the time. People get arrested for them. People go to trial. What was it that made you go, yeah, this is going to be my next book? Like, from the time you heard, I imagine that you were just doing your normal everyday book writing stuff, playing with a beautiful little white dog, and you were just doing whatever, and then you got the news, breaking news, Mark Hasse has been murdered. Did you know at that moment that this was going to be your next story, or did you just kind of... When did it click that this was going to be your next book?
You know, I watched it unfolding, and it was kind of fascinating the way that it happened. You know, it was all over the news, not just in Texas, but I'd get up in the morning, and it would be on Good Morning America or the Today Show. And I read an article that President Obama was monitoring it in the White House. And things just kind of kept popping up where I was seeing things, but I didn't really decide to do it until I read about Eric, because I really look for cases where it's kind of not the usual suspects,
right?
Where there's something really interesting about all the people involved, and you know, that was the case with this. And the other thing is that the more I found out about it, you're looking, when you're writing a true crime book, for a story that's kind of akin to writing a mystery, which I also write, where there are lots of twists and turns. You don't want something that's too simple, you know, that's just laid out. And this case had that. It had this really bizarre villain in Eric Williams, and it had all of the different twists and turns throughout their relationship, his relationship with Mike McClellan, that kind of made it like that Tombstone movie, you know, with the shootout at the OK Corral. You know, the shootout takes 2 seconds, but, you know, what led up to it evolved over a period of time. It's all about, these books are really all about relationships, and it's kind of like, sometimes when I'm working on a book, it's like the killer and the victim are trains barreling toward each other on the same track at night, and they can't see the other. You know they're going to hit. You know that there's going to be a big explosion, a giant crash. But at a certain point, they just can't stop.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
Well, forgive me for interrupting. I was saying that's what made A Warrant to Kill such a great book. That I was saying to you beforehand. Forgive me, total fanboy moment there.
That's true. In that case, that's true too. That, you know, I mean, Susan White in that book was going around saying, "I'm going to be killed," and when someone kills me, you know, Kent McGowan will have killed me. He's the one who will have done this to me. She saw it coming. A lot of times people, you know, in this book, Mark Hasse was walking around telling people he was afraid of Eric Williams. Mike McClellan was walking around saying, you know, Eric Williams killed Mark. You know, it's really about relationships. It's really about how these things develop and the psychology between all of them.
Right. Now, when you started doing all the writing and everything and you put it together, after all of the interviews, how do you know when you have enough interviews and you have enough information? Is it sort of instinctual that you go, yeah, you know what, I can stop here and start writing? Or do you have kind of like an outline, and then the outline just gradually gets bigger and bigger and bigger until it becomes like a draft?
Well, I stop interviewing when it gets to the point that I'm not learning anything new anymore.
Okay.
When I'm going out talking to people and everything I'm coming home with at night is akin to something I already have, then I feel like I've covered the case well enough. And I don't really start, the organizing takes a long time, because remember, I've got interviews with 100 people.
Right.
I went to death row and interviewed Eric 5 times. I was in Gatesville interviewing Kim 4 times. So, you know, I have just I think for this book, I have maybe three or four big legal boxes full of documents and research. So I have to kind of distill it all. And I do, this sounds ridiculous, but I'm a little bit older, so I went to school a long time ago. And back then, what they taught you in English class is that you take index cards, and you put all of your facts on them, and you shuffle them into a form. And I still do that. I put everything down. I'll have literally thousands of index cards, and I will shuffle them into chapters. And then within the chapter, I shuffle them into the way I want the chapter to flow. And then I sit down, and I use the index cards when I write. And everything's right there. I have the statistics, I have the quotes, I have the dates. It's all there, so I can just sit back and write them.
Right. So at some point when you're working on a book, is your office where you write, could you walk around in it at all? Or am I imagining like a floor, like almost tiled with index cards?
No,
and you've
got to
tell your husband, you're not allowed in here for the next 2 days, type of thing.
No, I can't do that, or my dog Nelson would be walking on the index cards. I do it on a dining room table, and sometimes it gets to the point where then I'm in the, it goes over to the kitchen table, And I think with this book, I actually had them on the dining room table, the kitchen table, and the island in the kitchen.
Oh, gosh. And so your
So,
husband basically saying, when we do dinner, it's on the TV trays in the
yeah, I
living room
know.
for the
And
next
it
month.
takes a while. I mean, it's a process that goes on for quite a period of time. So we didn't
Right.
invite anybody over for dinner for quite a while.
Nice. How, and that was my next question. From interview one till, and that is the end of my book, The End. How long is that process for you, would you say?
Well, it depends on the book. The quickest I've gotten through is about 7 or 8 months. Usually it's about a year. This book, I think, was maybe a little more than a little over a year, but not a lot. I have one book called Deliver Us that's on a whole group of cases, and that book took me 3 years, but that was an unusual book. But so it really kind of depends on the amount of research I have to do. The research is these. True crime is really research heavy.
Right, it really is. And I say this because I've written a couple of
I
I
know,
wrote a
yeah.
I wrote a book myself, and I'm writing stuff for the local newspaper. About local crimes and stuff like that from in the past. And it's amazing just how much time you spend doing that. Because one of the differences between writing true crime and writing fiction, and I don't know if you found this, is you've got to constantly go back and check your sources to make sure that what was said was the right thing. Because, like, if you sit there and you write something like, and Kim Williams said, oh, Eric is a big jerk, and Kim goes, I never said that. Then you've got to go back and check it and say, oh, he didn't say a big jerk. Say he was had a big hurt. So, and it like changes that. Whereas when you're writing a fiction novel, it's and Sarah ran as fast as she could. She stopped, hit the ground, and pulled her sidearm and began firing. You don't have to do that.
That's very true. I mean, and it writing fiction is really freeing for me after writing true crime for all these years, because I do get to make it up. And if the plot's not working, if I don't like what somebody did, I can just change it. And if I don't like a character, I can write them out, or
Right.
change them in some way. But with the true crime, it is the crime. It is the way it unfolded. So I do
Right,
my
and
best to be as accurate as I can.
right. After you've gotten through draft one, meaning all the facts are in there, how many drafts do you do, or do you have somebody else take a look at it, or how do you edit the book to get it into the second and third draft?
Well, I usually spend quite a bit of time. I'll go through it, doing rewrites. I'll probably go through it 4 or 5 times, and then it goes into the editor at the publishing house. And
Right.
my editor, HarperCollins, went over this book, and she came back. It was too long. I think I cut like 50 pages.
Wow.
Yeah, I could. I still now I look at it. I would have liked to have trimmed it a little bit more, but so I went in and she suggested some things I could do to make some cuts, and I found some others and I tightened it up. And it's just kind of a collaborative process between the writer and the editor. And then of
Right.
course there's the copy editor and all of the others. So.
Do you have to deal with I guess you call it a fact editor, where the person goes back and says, like, okay, Kim, did you say he had a big hurt, or how did you, or is that part of the process as well?
Well, I'll go through if there's something in there that's concerning. I'll have to show where I got it from, and I don't know that they've ever gone to a source to double check
Right.
something, but they'll come to me and they'll say, "Well, where did you get this? And do you have any backup for it?" That kind of thing.
Right. So
So.
that way you can say, like, okay, when the murderer claimed that he had the ability to turn invisible and walk through walls, and they go, did this guy really say this? Yeah, here's the recording. That type of thing. Now, I want to go back to the interview process, because from what I understand, everything that I saw, it was a big deal that Eric and Kim agreed to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
And you were the only person that was granted the interview. Did they know that you were basically going to write the facts of the book? And say what you will, they're murderers. They're cold, conniving murderers. She drove the getaway car. The reason an innocent woman is dead is because she allowed and cheerleaded on her husband and drove the car. And Eric did this, even though he still denies it. And I was reading someplace that he's been appealing all kinds of things due to brain injuries from diabetes and other stuff. And do they know that you're basically going to have to sit down and talk to them and go, hey, look, when I write this book, I'm not going to paint you as a sympathetic character. I'm going to state exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I've got 11 true crime books, so usually before I go in now, they've ordered a book and read it. So they know who I am, and I'm very upfront about who I am and what I'm doing there. I have a tape recorder out the whole time. And I show it to them. I don't hide it.
Right.
And, you know, and I ask tough questions. I ask them if they committed the murder. And I said to Eric at one point, Eric, you know, look at this evidence. And I laid it out for him. And he still denied it, but I didn't soft pedal anything. So, they know why I'm there. They know what I'm doing. I try to be really fair with people.
Right.
You know, I don't like to trick anyone into talking to me, so I'm pretty upfront about everything.
Right. I was going to say, one of the things that it reminds me of what you did was one of my other favorite true crime books is called The Monster Across From Me by John Douglas, and I hope I got that title right. And it was a mm-hmm. recent book that came out, and he discusses that he wanted to interview serial killers so that law enforcement agents could know this is what to look for, this is what to do, and so forth mm-hmm. and so on. And originally it was going to be a TV show, but the network was unhappy when he interviewed the serial killer that he wasn't going, like, he wasn't screaming like, listen, you horrible, horrible person.
Uh-huh.
It's like, boy, you're yeah. a pinhead, and I'm doing this for all of America. Backhand. They were, because John Douglas's attitude was, he doesn't come at it from, let me be sympathetic to what the killer did, but he is empathetic to what was said. So he would, to get the killer to talk. So he'll say something like, yeah, you were in a very unusual situation, weren't you? And he's like, yeah, well, that's why I had to choke the girl and then bury her in my backyard. Like, he mm-hmm. gets them to talk that way. And I mm-hmm. want to ask, is that the type of approach that you have when you're talking with individuals like this?
Yeah, you have to be just pretty matter of fact. You know, you can't, if I walked in there and I sat down with them and I told Eric that I thought he was a despicable human being, and, you know, that he had brutally murdered in cold blood these three people, which is all true, he never would have talked with me. But if I walked in there and said, Eric, I want to know about you, I want to know about your life, I want to understand what happened, all of that's very true, it's exactly why I'm there, then he'll talk. So sure, you don't want to walk in and put the other person in an adversarial position.
Right.
People won't talk to you then, and you're there to get information.
Right. Any idea as to how many convicted murderers you've had conversations with that you've interviewed?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I used to write for magazines, and I would go in to the prisons, working on articles for magazines, and I interviewed quite a few of them back in the day doing that. And then there are the books, and then when I was writing Deliver Us, I was going in interviewing serial killers. I've never added it up, Don. I have no idea.
That's just amazing. That's all I can say. The other thing was based that I found amazing was you reach out to a person that's been arrested and convicted of murder and say, I'd like to talk to you. I'm writing a book about the situation. And then they order a book that you've done. How surreal is it to see that? Like if I could use Eric Williams as an example, you're sitting there having a conversation with Eric Williams and he's holding us a copy of Deliver Us From Evil, or he's got another copy of Evil Beside Her. And then he's like giving you comments about books that you've written. It's sort of like, I imagine that just must be crazy. Just like you're interviewing a convicted murderer who's read your book about another convicted murderer you've written mm-hmm. about.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is a little odd. It really is. You know, it's just kind of part of all of it.
Right.
You know, you put the books out there. Well, you know, you've written books. You understand. You put the book out there, and the book kind of becomes an entity. It is an entity in its own right, and it's separate from you. And once it's done, it's like kind of like, well, that book's done. That one's out there. And you go on. But, you know, people do bring them up, and it's I don't know. Kim was funny. Kim had actually read my Sarah Armstrong mysteries.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, she reads fiction. I don't know that she actually read any of the true crime books, but it was when I wrote to her. She still to this day has never talked to anybody else, to any other reporters. And when I wrote to her, she wrote me back right away and said, "Oh, I love your mystery books."
Oh, wow.
So, you know.
Yeah. Do you keep up with the characters that are, I shouldn't say characters, do you keep up with the individuals that you have written about? Like, if there's, say, just for argument's sake, your book ends with Eric on death row. Let's just say that there's a whole other trial because, like I said, articles have said that he's appealing based on diabetes and brain damage issues and other things like that. If it turns around that the whole – I don't want to say like the whole thing gets thrown out, or there's a second trial and he is then sentenced to life in prison, do you then go back and add another chapter to your book, or how would that work, or have you had to do that with any of your other books?
Well, I did it with Warrant to Kill, because Kent McGowan didn't go back. He didn't go to prison right away.
Right.
And there was a successful appeal, so I went back and then rewrote the epilogue, rewrote the epilogue, as I remember it.
Right.
Right now, I have a book called Shattered on the David Temple case, and that book in that case was actually reversed on appeal, and David was retried this past year and convicted a second time, and we're actually waiting. The jury hung up on sentencing, so there's going to be a retrial on the sentencing phase. So that one's actually kind of in the works.
Right.
And when it's all done, if HarperCollins agrees, I'll go in and I'll update the book at the end.
Right. Catherine, I cannot even begin to thank you for your time. I have absolutely enjoyed this conversation. This has been absolutely wonderful. I feel like it's been an absolute honor for me to talk with you tonight, and I have just so enjoyed myself.
Well, I appreciate it, Don. It was kind of you to ask me. I've enjoyed it as well.
Okay, my friends, please check out Catherine's website. It's Catherine, and she spells it a very distinct way and a very interesting way. It's Katherine Casey, Casey.com. We will have a link for it in our podcast. We will also have links to her book, In Plain Sight. And we will also, I'm still a massive fan of Warrant to Kill, so I'm going to have a link to that as well as my personal favorite. And please buy the book. It is such a wonderful read. I tell you, it's very few people that you can meet that is as good of a novelist as they are a true crime writer, and Catherine Casey is one of them. And it's also worth your time just to check out. Number one, it's entertaining. And if you're anything like me, where you're a student of true crime and you want to learn how to both write and you want to learn more about true crime, you could do no better than finding Catherine Casey's books. They should frankly be required reading in law enforcement academies all over the world. And I'm going to push for that. I will do that. I will re-elect anyone that will make Catherine Casey's books required reading in law enforcement academies.
Well, thank you, Dan. That's very sweet.
So, anyway, everyone, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Don't forget, we have our Facebook page. Check it out. Also, we are at conversationsofthestrange.blogspot.com. Check us out there. And Conversations of the Strange is on most of the major podcast platforms, Spotify, Apple, iTunes, and Google Play. So listen there. With that said, everybody, thank you so much for joining me. I am Don Smith, and I've been your host. And have a great night. Catherine, I hate to tell you this, but you have made a fan for me for life.
Oh.
So,
wow, that's wonderful. If you're ever in Houston, let me know. Maybe we can grab a cup of coffee or lunch.
I would love. I am going to have to come to Houston just for this.
Oh,
I really
well, that would
will.
Be wonderful.
That
would
I
be
will.
One. But don't fly now, Don, because it's not safe now. So down the road.
No. We'll do a road trip.
Good.
Yeah. And what I'll do is, if you're ever interested and you like horror or anything like that, I'll be more than happy to. I would love to send you copies of my stuff.
I'd love to read it. Why don't you send it to my P.O. box? It's have you got a pen?
Sure.
It's P.O. 1525.
1525, okay.
Tomball, Texas.
Humble?
Tomball, T-O-M-B-A-L-L, all one word, Texas, 77377.
Okay, first chance I get, I will be sending something out to you. I will tell you, I'll send you a lot of my fiction stuff out, or at the very least, what I'll do is I'll print up copies, because a lot of the stuff I've been working with right now has been strictly online. So,
oh, okay, well, just send me one of your books, whichever one you'd like me to read.
And I definitely...
I'd be delighted to read it.
Thank you so much. Catherine, it is... I'm still just amazed. I'm just beside myself with just how awesome this conversation has been, and I have really enjoyed our time together.
Well, I enjoyed it, too. Well, you have a really good evening.
Thank you, and I'm going to hold you... I'm going to put you on the spot. Any interest in coming and talking about your Sarah Armstrong books?
Oh, maybe down the road. You know, I've got a new mystery series starting in June. The first book comes out in June. So maybe like in the fall or maybe when the second book comes out, Don?
Yeah, that
is
would
that okay?
Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm going to hold you to that. I would love to do that. I think it would be so much fun to talk with you about it.
Okay, that would be great. I'll look forward to it.
All right. Take care, and
you
my best to Nelson.
Thanks. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye.
Welcome to Conversations of the Strange.
Conversations of the Strange.